ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello there, it's Andrew West with this special episode of the Religion and Ethics Report here on ABC Radio National, ABC Listen, and across the Pacific on Radio Australia. I'm actually at the south end of the beach in Sydney's eastern suburbs. As you almost certainly know, a few days ago, an unspeakable massacre took place close to the north end of Bondi Beach. Two gunmen, at this stage police believe they're possibly inspired by the Islamic State terrorist group, murdered 15 people, nearly all of them Jews attending an event for Hanukkah, a festival of light. I felt a bit funny about being too close to the scene or using it as a journalistic backdrop. On this episode of the show, we're going to have to ask some tough questions about how we got here, but we're also going to ask how to preserve the ethnic and religious pluralism that characterises modern Australia. But let's go first to someone who's made religious understanding his life. Well, amidst the tragedy of the last few days, I found a little refuge in a garden in Sydney, not too far from where the Bondi Beach massacre occurred. I'm with someone I've known for almost two decades. Rabbi Zalman Castell is an extraordinary man who now runs an extraordinary organisation, the Together for Humanity Foundation. Zalman grew up in New York, actually in a very closed Jewish community, but because he loves his faith and because he lives his faith, he wants to reach out and to spend a lifetime reaching out and becoming, I know he's a modest man, but I would argue, one of the world's leading advocates for interfaith relations. Zalman, welcome back to the Religion and Ethics Report.
Wonderful to be with you again, Andrew.
There's a certain sad poetry in our meeting today because you were actually on the very first episode of the Religion and Ethics Report in 2012. We were in the northern suburbs of Sydney and there was a campaign being run against the erection of an almost invisible wire that would create an eruv. An eruv being an area, a neighbourhood, not very big, where Orthodox Jews can go about necessary business on the Sabbath. The campaign against the eruv was, I think, mean-spirited. But how did we get, Zalman, from mean-spirited to mass murder?
Wow. I think it's important, firstly, to recognize that there are different layers of responsibility and culpability or blame. There's a difference between recognizing that we all have responsibility for our circles of influence, responsibility, the ability to respond or to initiate and influence what happens around us, and the blame for the behaviors of perpetrators, of criminals. So while there were two people who pulled the trigger, and they are primarily to blame for what happened, we can also think about the ways in which we learn or don't learn about each other. And this is a long-standing problem going back to the times of the pharaohs. So how does it happen? It happens with dehumanization. It happens with a lack of curiosity. It happens with a lack of open-hearted seeking to understand one's neighbor. It happens when there is a lack of tolerance for people who believe or feel differently to oneself.
Before we get into some of those bigger questions, it does not surprise me that you, as an Orthodox rabbi, very high profile, very active in your community, know some of the victims of the massacre in Bondi. Just share with me, if you can, some of their stories.
Rabbi Eli Schlanger is related to my brother's wife's family. He's my brother's wife's brother. He was a beautiful man, a lot of joy, a lot of positivity. I recently was collecting my son from a gathering with Rabbi Eli, and I thought I'd just pick up my son and get in the car, but I didn't. I sat and listened to Rabbi Eli and listened to the way that he talked to the young people with such authenticity. You know, young people respond to authenticity. And I don't remember what he said, but I remember how he said it. I remember the spirit he brought to that conversation. And it moved me greatly, what he was saying. It was beautiful. And also Rabbi Eli was really keen to spread understanding of the seven Noahide laws. One of the last conversations I've had with him was honoring the teachings of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who wanted non-Jewish people to understand that Judaism doesn't expect everyone to be Jewish. Jews don't have a need or desire to convert everyone. Judaism believes that all of us can be good with God by obeying seven simple principles. And Rabbi Eli was really keen on that and wanted non-Jewish people to learn about that. He'd spoken to some children from some Christian schools about these seven Noahide laws. And I'll always cherish sitting at the corner of this long table of him talking to a bunch of Hasidic boys with such warmth and authenticity.
Just speaking about his attitude as an Orthodox rabbi, again, not compromising in any way any of his beliefs, but an openness to it. Aside from the obvious, what struck me as so horrid about what occurred was that that Hanukkah festival was on a public beach. Anyone could take part. The Orthodox Jews had set it up, but it was for anyone who wanted to take part. How does that reflect what you have done? You work with Christians, with Muslims, people of every faith. How does that reflect the mindset that you, I fear, you may struggle to maintain in Australia?
Rabbi Eli and also Rabbi Yaakov Levitin both grew up in the same community as I did, with the influence of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. It's an outward-looking movement in various ways. There are nuances. I should also honor Rabbi Yaakov. We had a conversation recently about a certain incident of dehumanization, and Rabbi Yaakov was very concerned about this. Happened to be dehumanization of Muslims. He was very deeply committed against the dehumanization of any person, in that particular case, the dehumanization of Muslims. The spirit of Hanukkah, the spirit of taking light into the public sphere, into the public spaces, contributing, participating in the public conversation. Hanukkah also is a festival, in a sense, a festival of tolerance. The story is about an empire that tried to enforce conformity on its society, to control their colonies by enforcing cultural conformity, religious conformity, and this was a pushing back against that, and the miracles of the success against pushing conformity, religious conformity, on the Jewish people of that time. I am redoubled in my commitment to fostering interfaith harmony. The experience of the last 2 days have been nonstop, receiving messages of support, very honest conversations with Muslim leaders at various levels, deep concern, compassion, talking about rahma, about divine mercy and how we're supposed to behave with mercy, tears with Muslims and people of other backgrounds, Aboriginal leader, a Hindu leader. The Bishop of Lismore was kind enough to call me the other day, another bishop. I mean, it's just been a marathon of compassion and care and support.
But I do wonder, though, Zalman, whether there's going to be some people in your community who are going to say very tearfully, Zalman, there's no point. The thing to which you've dedicated your life, there's no point now. Save yourself, save your patience, save yourself. There's no point continuing. How do you fight that completely understandable mindset?
Yeah, I don't. I don't fight it. I don't share it, but I don't fight it. I encourage tolerance and understanding for all kind of different perspectives and people who have different journeys. I was talking to an Islamic leader today who has been on the journey with me for over 15 years, and I said, in the internal conversations that people need to have in the different communities, we need to recognize that we've all had different opportunities. Not all of us have had the opportunities for deep listening, for close bonds, long road trips. I've cooked on a sandwich maker. I know this has become popular now in some other quarters, but long before people use sandwich makers for cooking meals for political alliances, I've been using them for interfaith work, for kosher and halal food up in Darwin, cooking on a sandwich maker. I was vegetarian. I didn't cook any steaks on it because I used that sandwich maker also for milk. And of course, Jewish people don't mix milk and meat. But one of my wonderful memories from Darwin was cooking vegetables vegetables on a sandwich maker for a Lebanese imam. So I did it first.
Yeah. There's almost no points of light to come out of this tragedy. But there is that extraordinary story, though, of Ahmed al-Ahmed.
Yes.
The man of Syrian background, a Muslim Australian. How do you take that extraordinary act of courage? In fact, one Israeli newspaper has said he is now part of the righteous among nations. Hmm. How do you take his story and make it something bigger?
One of the religious traditions don't often behave with a lot of generosity towards other traditions. There's a story lifted from Islam about the lesser and the greater jihad in a Jewish text, but it's there without retribution. One of the exceptions to that is the Islamic teaching that God told the Israelites, or the Bnei Israel, the children of Israel, of Jacob, that whoever destroys one life is as if they've destroyed the whole world. And if one saves one life, it's as if they've saved the whole world. And that is actually in the Talmud, in different versions, in the Babylonian Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud. That idea of the absolute sanctity of human life, this incredibly courageous man, Ahmed, personified in his behavior to literally take a bullet for Jewish people. Perhaps I've seen some report it was for the preservation of life regardless. You know, he can tell his own story when it's ready. But I think in terms of the larger picture, that idea of entrenched us and them thinking, that idea that all of us are tribal first, the backstory to our Jewish version of that idea that one person equals the universe is leading back to the creation story. Mm. And the creation story is about the creation of one human. And that this one human, it actually has two permutations in the Talmud, two explanations. Why would humanity begin with one human? One is because of this teaching that is shared between both of our faiths, that one person is equal to all of mankind. The other is also about a rejection of superiority, that no one can say, my ancestor is greater than your ancestor. Yeah. Actually, there's one race, the human race. We have one common ancestor, according to my faith and the faith of Christians and Muslims. That's a common ancestor. And I think his action is a reminder that all human life is absolutely sacred.
Just finally, very practical thing. Together for Humanity does a lot of work in schools.
Yes.
Not just Jewish schools. In fact, mostly not Jewish schools. What's next?
Part of the education needs to be about how to disagree, how to deal with grievance, how to deal with injustice, how to be a citizen, a global citizen and a local citizen. What we need to learn about is listening from a place of not knowing, deeply trying to understand other people's experiences, and how do we advance human dignity and justice and compassion, safety, in ways that are ethical. I don't believe there's a problem with anger. In the Torah, in a metaphorical sense, we have God getting angry. But we also have anger that is misdirected. Moses gets angry and hits the rock and stuffs up. So anger is a useful, sometimes useful emotion, and sometimes it's destructive. And the question is anger channeled to correcting problems in society, or is anger just diffuse and belittling? When Moses gets angry, he belittles people, in some ways humiliates others. That's not constructive anger. So as a society, we need to broaden our toolkit for interfaith engagement from limited, maybe gentle ways of learning about what we have in common to a deep dive into also what we have that is different, and how do we disagree in ways that preserve human dignity?
Rabbi Zalman Castell, the founder of Together for Humanity, thank you very much for your time. I try not to get emotional, but also thank you very much for the enveloping love that you have, and thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
And this is the Religion and Ethics Report on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew West. This massacre of 15 people was clearly an anti-Semitic attack. Quite understandably, there's a call for a reckoning about how we got to this point.
Peter Curti is a senior fellow at the Centre for Independent Studies. He's written extensively about the growing anti-Semitism after the Hamas attack on Israel in October 2023 and then Israel's subsequent war on Gaza.
Well, I think there were a lot of red flags, and leaders of the Jewish community had been warning the Albanese government for a long time that after the 7th of October invasion of Israel by Hamas, the number of anti-Semitic incidents in Australia spiked. There was a real surge. Despite warnings, repeated warnings from the community about attacks on property and individuals and graffiti, and of course these almost violent protests in the sense that even if they weren't actually violent themselves, they inflamed violent emotions and I think incited violence and certainly incited hatred. These were the sorts of red flags that I think indicated to many that there was a danger and that an attack such as the one we saw on Sunday evening was not, whilst unbelievable in one level, was not unbelievable at all and was in fact something to be expected.
Yeah, in a piece for the Wall Street Journal, we'll put a link to that, you say, I guess in not so many words, that anti-Semitism has in recent years been rationalised away in Australia. How?
I think that's because the discussions and debate about Israel and about Judaism and about the well-being of Jews in Australia has been channeled into a debate about a war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. And this has aroused all sorts of opinions, memories, views about the legitimacy of the State of Israel, about the legitimacy of settlements in the occupied West Bank, which of course was territory that Israel captured in the 1967 Six-Day War. It's inflamed that sense that Israel is oppressing the Palestinians, that they are perpetrating great acts of injustice that need to be remedied. And I think this is what has fired opinion, this what I think has inflamed sentiment to the point that people can't see that the behavior that they're engaged in verges on hatred and in some instances crosses over it and becomes hatred.
Yeah, you also say that anti-Semitism is not just another form of prejudice. I certainly recall a comment by the British writer Neil Aitchison. He said that anti-Semitism was the longest hatred. Why is anti-Semitism different?
Anti-Semitism is different because it's not just another form of racial or ethnic or religious hatred. It's a form of prejudice against Jews that is ancient. It's one that morphs and takes on different forms at different times. These days, it finds expression through anti-Zionism and the notion that questions about the legitimacy of the State of Israel, which in my view, do in fact cut across and become anti-Semitic. For example, with other forms of discrimination or hatred, like racial hatred, one might just have a dislike of people who have another characteristic, skin color or gender. The thing about anti-Semitism is it actually encompasses the whole of life. The Jews are accused of being conspirators. They're accused of having all the power of controlling money and wealth and the means of production and the media. So we hear these fantastical conspiracy stories that I think allow Jews to be blamed for almost everything that happens in a society. Anti-Semitism is quite different because it's a sort of hatred that seeps into the crevices of a society and stains it so that everything can be seen as being the fault of the Jews. And when that happens, there is a great danger not just to Jewish citizens in a society, but to all citizens.
Yeah, well, that's a piece that you make in the Wall Street Journal piece. Look, this is emphatically not what you are trying to do, but how do we ensure that we're not creating a hierarchy of hate?
We avoid a notion of a hierarchy of hate because anti-Semitism is a very different form of hatred. The Albanese government has been at pains to make it equivalent to Islamophobia, but Islamophobia is a very, very different phenomenon. That is not to say that there aren't people in our society who hate Muslims. I mean, there are, and that's something that happens throughout the West. And so I would say, in response to your question about hierarchy, that there is no hierarchy here. Anti-Semitism is a very different form of hatred. It's distinct, it's historically lethal, it's conspiratorial, it's adaptive, and that it's corrosive of democratic trust. Because once we start to distrust a group of citizens fantasizing about their exercise of power, once we sow seeds of distrust in that sector of society, it will spread to others. I know the Islamophobia envoy, Aftab Malik, he's a good man, and I know that he has got challenges in his own area of work. And I've read his report, his plan. But I do think it's a very different phenomenon from that that is now confronting not just Australian Jews, but Australian society as a whole.
Now, you've written a recent paper for the Centre Independent Studies. We'll put a link to it. It's called Drawing the Line, Moral Conflict and the Fragility of Liberal Tolerance. Where do we draw the line, Peter, given what we've seen in the last 2 years?
Drawing the line is always difficult. In a liberal democracy where we cherish freedom and we value freedom and where the foundations of our democracy depend upon the exercise of that freedom. But lines can be drawn, and one of the markers, one of the boundaries, is identified by hate. And I think where hatred is promoted, where violence is incited and members of a society are harmed or genuinely feel threatened, the state has a duty to act and draw a line and say that kind of behavior, that kind of discourse is not acceptable. But it's not just about whether people feel threatened or feel in danger. I think another important element of drawing the line is ensuring that there is institutional integrity. So, for example, you know, the police I happen to see today are outside the Great Synagogue here in Sydney. Armed police and people are placing floral tributes. But there were no armed police guarding this Hanukkah celebration.
A sad sign, though, isn't it, that we need police outside synagogues?
It's a tragedy. This tragedy at Bondi, which I think has rocked the nation, actually, because Bondi Beach, an iconic Australian landmark, a warm, sunny summer's afternoon, people gathering for religious purposes. They might have been going about any other kind of worship, but Australians gathering to worship in peace and tranquility, that is completely fractured. The consequences of this will be with us for a very long time.
Peter Curti, Director of the Culture, Prosperity and Civil Society Program at the Centre for Independent Studies. And Peter has written extensively on the growth of anti-Semitism, particularly in the last couple of years. Thanks for coming back to the Religion and Ethics Report.
Great to be with you, Andrew. Thanks.
There's a lot to think about in Peter Curti's words. One huge question is whether our multicultural model can survive. Emeritus Professor Andrew Yakubovich lives not too far from here. He's a Jewish Australian and he's an internationally recognised scholar of multiculturalism.
Well, I think they've stretched certain elements of the model, for sure. It's a very difficult situation and it's not one that we haven't seen at a maybe smaller level in the past with other countries where there have been other conflicts. One of the big challenges for a multicultural society is actually trying to work out how you get intercultural communication going effectively. In some of our cities, and Sydney is a particular one, there's quite a lot of concentration of different groups in different areas. That makes it a bit more difficult for people to interact and learn about each other. But the willingness to understand differences is really at the heart of the process. We've been reasonably okay about getting rid of racial barriers to migration. We've been moderately okay about trying to understand how a multicultural society works. And we've been fairly piss off, if I can use that term, in developing strategies for intercultural communication and collaboration. And it's that last one which I think is now seeing the greatest tension.
Yeah. It reminds me of a comment that I read in the 24 hours after the massacre at Bondi. Andrew Bolt writing in the Daily Telegraph and the Herald Sun. Now, in fairness, he was capturing the emotion of the moment. But he said, look, this model is broken because we've become a nation of tribes. And there are people within the tribes who don't accept mainstream comity. And it did occur to me that maybe he was onto something. I mean, you say that we are a nation where many communities are separate. Have we become this broken nation of tribes?
The idea of a nation of tribes is not new. John Howard ran with it 20 years ago when we had the issues at Cronulla. These are constant stresses in a multicultural society. Are we tribal? Some communities are more tribal than others, and I wouldn't want to identify which are more than others. I mean, it just changes. But the crucial thing that works here, and that's the reason Australia is a very creative, effective society in many ways, is because people do collaborate irrespective of their backgrounds. They do join together. The last couple of years, particularly since October the 7th, has been very stressful for the Jewish community and for the communities associated with Palestinians.
Right.
Absolutely. But they're not the whole of Australian society by any means at all. And there are other crises and other pressures elsewhere. But in a sense, to allow a couple of gunmen to set the agenda for the whole country is just bananas. Treat them as they were, criminals, whatever else they discover about them. But it's not intellectually valid to then project that onto everybody who might be in any way linked to them. One identified person who intervened in this whole event publicly at the testing of his own life was in fact a Muslim. So whatever's going on there, it's not about Muslims. It's about people with particular and very nasty political views. I won't say more about that because there's a whole debate and argument going on about that. But in the Australian context, in the research that I've been doing recently, I've been very interested to examine what are the dynamics that mean that groups actually can collaborate and what are the dynamics that turn them off. And I've talked to leaders from Muslim communities, Jewish communities and so on over a period of time. They each tell me exactly the same thing. Things would be much better if only they recognised our pain.
Yeah.
And then I say to them, well, would you be the first to recognise the pain of the other without any guarantee that they would recognise yours? And they are really jumpy about that because there are people on the more extreme ends of their own communities who would get really angry with them. So this is a problem. Right, a very real problem, but it's not one that is impenetrable and it's not one that's impossible to resolve.
Should we ban hate speech? Because you've done a lot of research on this. You've seen what you believe to be a hole in our laws. Should we ban hate speech? Can we ban hate speech?
Way back in the 1960s, Australia signed on to the International Convention for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. With a small number of other countries, we put in a statement saying we were not prepared to accept Article 4. Article 4 is the one that criminalises hate speech. It's a broad context, but it's a statement to the society that it's not on, right? And this stuff can destroy a society very easily. So I think you can sign on to the International Convention. Neither the government nor the previous government has ever had any appetite to do that. I think that is a major mistake and that should be overturned immediately. It's an easy thing to do and it's a signal of seriousness to everybody.
Professor Andrew Yakubovich, Emeritus Professor of Sociology at the University of Technology, Sydney, longtime scholar of the Australian Multicultural Project. Thank you for sharing your thoughts and your wisdom with us, Andrew.
Thanks, Andrew.
That is it for this special episode of the Religion and Ethics Report here on ABC Radio National. You can also find us at ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. A big thanks to producer Mandy Roberts and executive producer Mudita Dias. I'm Andrew West.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.